I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, remember William Kunstler? He was the self-described radical lawyer, a central player in the turbulent 60s and beyond, famous for taking on the most unpopular cases and clients. Now, two of his daughters have made a film about their famous father. The documentary is called Disturbing the Universe, and we'll tell you more about it in just a few minutes. But first, do you remember when you were told to eat everything on your plate because children in other countries were going hungry? Well, we've learned this week that there are many people in this country who don't have enough to eat. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is reporting that hunger in the U.S. is higher than at any time since the government began tracking it 14 years ago. Nearly 50 million people struggled to get enough nutritious food last year. The number includes almost one in four children. The key factor, of course, is the recession. Workers are earning less money or are unemployed, and poverty continues to rise. Joining us to talk more about this are Jan Pruitt, president and CEO of North Texas Food Bank. She's in Chicago right now for a conference on hunger. And also U.S. Representative Gwen Moore of Wisconsin. She's been a longtime advocate of programs that provide food to low-income families. Her own experience includes a time as a single mother when she received government assistance while earning a college degree. Thank you both ladies for joining us.
Great being here.
Congressman Moore, if I could start with you, you've seen the study. What's most striking to you about the numbers? Are you surprised by this?
Oh, absolutely not surprised. And we've seen these numbers rise steadily. And, of course, they've risen more steeply with this recession. And I think it's extremely important for us to all recognize that there is no safety net. Especially for children.
I think that that's the thing that is surprising to many people. I think many people assume that there's a safety net in the form of food stamps and in the form of the school lunch and in some cases school breakfast programs. And then when all else fails, there's the sort of private volunteer efforts through food banks and the like. And we're going to hear more about that, obviously, from Jan. But why is it that the whatever safety net is in place right now is not sufficient to keep people from going hungry?
Well, I can tell you that it's onerous. It's hard to administer. You know, I live in Wisconsin. Of course, we're 43rd in the nation for providing school breakfasts. I just recently had signed into law a bill that expanded the ability to provide suppers to children in the school setting. We have all this means testing instead of just providing school lunch. You know, we require parents to send back forms, and if they don't, they don't get the lunches. There's stigma attached to receiving a school lunch, and we need to end some of the bureaucracy.
Jan, let's go to you. The report says that nationally, an average of 14.6% of households had difficulty providing food for family members in 2006 through 2008. Texas ranked second for food insecurity, following only Mississippi. Can you just tell us a little bit more about what you're seeing with the agencies that you work with? What are they seeing?
You know, similarly to Congresswoman Moore, I was not surprised by these numbers. Our agencies are telling us that they're seeing 36% more new faces coming to their door than they did this time last year. At the same time, the North Texas Food Bank's distribution is up. You know, we had planned for about a 16% increase, and we're on track to have a 33% increase this year.
And are you seeing, can I ask, are you seeing people who you have not seen before? You're saying new faces, but are you seeing people from different parts of the community who you haven't seen, different neighborhoods, different demographic backgrounds than you hadn't seen before?
Absolutely. Food banks have concentrated on the working poor because those are the families that have struggled to keep food on their table, people who work but don't have enough money to feed their family. Now it's professionals, people that have been laid off. We've had people like an engineer. He lost his job. He had been making $100,000 a year, lost his home, lost his, you know, had used up his savings and was actually sitting down filling out a food stamp application with one of our outreach workers. That's kind of the new face of hunger right now.
And could you pick up a little bit on the point that Congresswoman Moore made about the whole process of getting food stamps? Because I think the thing that we still want to get to is why does whatever safety net exists now, why isn't it sufficient to provide all these people? Is the process for getting food stamps very, very difficult, for example?
Well, I think the concept of a safety net is something that we all believe, you know, exists out there for us. And the reality is that safety net has some pretty big holes in it. One of them is the fact that you cannot get food stamps unless you're at 130% of poverty or below. the people that are really struggling because they cannot get any kind of government help or very limited government help are people at 130 to, say, 185% of poverty, approximately $40,000 for a family of four, which is difficult, especially in Dallas, Texas, to live on. The process is difficult, and in Texas, the system is really struggling because of an attempt to privatize the food stamp system a couple of years ago, just all kinds of problems, and then the recession and the number of people coming into the offices. We had some waits a couple of months ago for approximately 60 days. That's from the time you give your application to the time you get an appointment. You're waiting 60, 90 days to get that appointment at a time when you're needing to feed your family today.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm speaking with Congresswoman Gwen Moore of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Jan Pruitt, President and CEO of North Texas Food Bank. We're talking about a new report by the Department of Agriculture that says that the number of Americans lacking consistent access to adequate food soared last year. It's the highest level since the government began tracking what it calls food insecurity 14 years ago. Congresswoman, do you mind if I ask your personal story?
Sure. I don't know how I did it, but I went to school without breakfast or lunch all through elementary school and junior high school. And finally, when I got to the 11th grade, I picked up the school lunch, walked to the cashier, declared, I'm going to sit down and eat this, and I'm going to come back and do it again tomorrow. There was a little rumble in the kitchen, and they left me alone. You know, I went through school during a time when they said that if I were receiving food assistance or welfare, and my mom was receiving aid, then it would be a duplication of services for them to give me a free school lunch. And I just rebelled against that. I just said, you know, I was an A student, and then I went on to become a single parent where I needed food stamps. And so I experienced hunger personally. And, you know, I'm determined as a legislator to do everything that I can. I mean, I've worked diligently in the state legislature and here in Congress on high-tech kind of legislation, like trying to provide suppers for kids after school, providing universal breakfast programs. I just wanted to track in on a point that Jan made I thought was really important, and that is when she talked about middle-class folk needing more assistance. When you stop and think about the Thrifty Food Plan, which is a bare minimum amount of money that you need, subsistence level for a family of four, being $117 per week, you realize that the cost of food has increased tremendously, and it is not tracked adequately with the amount of food support that we provide. And I think that this is something that we need to address. So while we increase the numbers, while there is a diligent effort here in Congress to increase numbers of dollars that are available through our food and feeding programs, we need to really evaluate the income levels at which people are eligible for these programs.
Well, some of the things, Congresswoman, just briefly, if we can, because we're almost out of time, some of the things that you've talked about have already taken place. For example, the stimulus plan passed by Congress, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which was passed last winter, raised the average monthly food stamp benefit per person by about 17%. The WIC rules have changed to allow people to buy more nutritious food, more fresh food, not just sort of the shelf, long shelf life staples that people are accustomed to. Some of those things have already taken place. Are there other things that you think need to happen from a policy perspective to address this issue? And I do want to just emphasize one point. There are those who criticize the methodology of the study. They say that it overstates the problem, that people say if they say they are experiencing food insecurity, it's not a long-term issue. It may be for a couple of days, for example. So I just want to point out that there is another perspective on this.
People who are eating who are saying that.
Yes, ma'am. But I just want to point out there's another perspective. So if I could just get you to tell me what else you think needs to happen right now.
You know, I have been a long advocate of doing a real thorough analysis of what poverty is, giving increased costs for fuels and energy and other things that contribute to an adequate life in the United States. Yes, and I do agree that we've provided more monies through these programs, but we need a safety net. I think that when you look at the food stamp program, for example, and how it's administered, there are severe consequences for states making errors and mistakes in terms of families who aren't qualified. I think we need to reduce some of those strictures. I think we need universal eligibility for school lunches. I mean, if there's a school district like mine in Wisconsin where 80% of the kids are eligible for a free lunch, we ought not have a reduced lunch. And if you don't send in the application, you're not eligible. We ought to have, if you're eligible for one kind of program, then you're automatically presumed eligible for other programs.
Interesting. I see what you're saying. Jan Pruitt, final thought from you. What do you think would help?
Well, Michelle, exactly what the Congresswoman said, looking at the poverty line, that number has not changed, or the calculations for the poverty line has not changed since the 1950s. The Thrifty Food Plan has not changed since the 60s when the program was established. That is the basis of all this, because families, even if you're on food stamps, you're going to a food pantry by the end of the month because it's not enough to feed your family. And there's not enough donated food out there to help families. We need help.
Jan Pruitt is president and CEO of North Texas Food Bank. She joined us from the studios of Chicago Public Radio. She's in Chicago attending a conference about solutions to combat hunger. U.S. Representative Gwen Moore of Wisconsin joined us by phone from her home office. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
And thank you, too.
Thank you.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, a former prosecutor talks about what the fight for social justice means now. His prescription for change may surprise you. That conversation a little later. But first, when you hear the name William Kunstler, you may think of the internationally known civil rights lawyer who fought for civil rights in the segregated South, who defended anti-war protesters in Chicago, and who negotiated in behalf of protesting inmates at Attica Prison in New York and American Indians at Wounded Knee, South Dakota. Or you might think of the man who embraced mobster John Gotti, represented an accused New York cop shooter, and a suspect in the first World Trade Center bombings. But if you are Emily Kunstler and Sarah Kunstler, then you think of the man you loved and admired as your father. The two have made a documentary about their father's life titled William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe. And they join us now from our New York Bureau to talk about it. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
Sarah, I'll start with you just because you're the elder by, 2 years, I think it is. And you had a very unusual upbringing. You said that when most kids were afraid of ghosts and monsters, you were afraid of something else. What were you afraid of?
We were afraid of the police, the president, and the FBI.
And how? Why is that?
Because we were afraid that our father was a target. During our lifetime, he took controversial cases, and there was a lot of visible aggression towards him. People would call our house and say mean things. When Emily and I picked up the phone, there were protesters in front of our house. You know, our father would joke with us when he went to court that he was packing a toothbrush because he might be hauled off to jail for contempt of court. It was those were scary things for a kid.
You say that by the time you were born, you say your father's glory days were behind him. Emily, what do you mean by that?
Sarah and I grew up hearing about the work that he did in the South and the work that he did during the anti-war movement. During our lifetime, we saw a much different person. So it was hard in a child's mind to reconcile the two.
Was he a nice dad?
Yeah. I mean, he was definitely a nice dad. You know, he was a public person, but he still took the time to throw the ball around in front of the house with us and would take Sarah and I on alternating trips with him when he would travel to give speeches or make court appearances across the country.
You talk about this trip to the Supreme Court where he says that he was arguing a case about a First Amendment case involving flag burning. And he talks about, what did he say? What was the phrase he used? That
This is Sarah. He told us that the Supreme Court was the World Series for lawyers. He was thrilled to be going to the Supreme Court to argue a case.
And it was like the way some kids would take a field trip. You know, you're going to the Supreme Court. You know, it's not the typical field trip or trip out of town with dad. But you talk in the film about how by the time you were, you know, young teens, you began to have some qualms about some of your father's clients. In fact, you say in the film that dad's clients gave us nightmares. Which ones?
This is Emily speaking. You know, our father was defending Yousef Salam, who was accused of brutally raping the Central Park jogger, and El Said Nosair, who was accused of murdering Rabbi Kahana, and people who would shoot cops, and it just didn't seem consistent with the stories that he had told us.
I think this film might be surprising to some people who think that because you are William Kunstler's daughters, you're going to try to sort of deify him or gloss over the very polarizing positions that he took or some of the cases that he took that really pushed a lot of people's buttons, but you don't. In fact, you face that issue very squarely and very early in the film. For example, here you interview the famed criminal lawyer and law professor Alan Dershowitz, who told you that he too felt conflicted about some of your father's cases. Here's a short clip.
It's very, very hard to look Bill Kunstler's daughter in the eye and to say that I thought he was a hypocrite. It's a very hard question. But I do have to say that I think he sometimes acted inconsistently with the principles that he stated and articulated.
Sarah, first can I ask, why did he think that?
Alan Dershowitz doubted that Bill loved the people he represented later in his career. So to take that public stance, I only represent people I love or people whose causes I support, and then to represent people accused of bombing the World Trade Center or raping a jogger in Central Park, that was hypocritical.
But you do go into the trajectory of his life. You start, for example, when he came back from World War II. He went to law school on the GI Bill, and you say he started out doing pretty mundane legal work, lived in the suburbs, had that kind of classic middle-class existence. And then something changed for him. Emily, what is it that caused him to start on the path that later became his life?
He got a call from the ACLU to go be a witness when the Freedom Riders got off the bus in Mississippi. And he went down south, and he watched these really brave people risk arrest, brutality, and prison time, and he was blown away. He realized then that it was really getting out there and doing something that mattered, and it changed the course of his life.
Your father was one of the lawyers representing a group who'd protested at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. They were charged with inciting to riot and other related charges. The trial became known as the Chicago 8. It was later the Chicago 7. There were these famous exchanges between your father and the judge, Judge Julius Hoffman. Here's a short clip.
I ask you to sit down.
Your Honor, I think the marshal's going to have to this time put me in my seat. I am not going to sit down unless I am forced to sit down.
I've had enough of your insults, Miss Bush.
Your Honor, let I not be insulting.
You sit down, sir, or we'll arrange to have you put down.
The whole trial was a very shocking experience to many people watching it. At one point, one of the defendants, Bobby Seale, an African-American, was gagged and bound to his chair for speaking out of turn. And Sarah, I just was interested to, I think you're a lawyer as well, right?
Yes, I am.
And so for you, I mean, being a lawyer yourself and going through the, sort of the whole process of going to law school and so forth like this, what was it like for you to kind of watch this whole scene play out?
It's really liberating because in law school, you're taught to conform. And that's part of the reason why it's so exciting for us to get to show this film to law student audiences. While you might not be in the same kind of confrontation that Bill was in that courtroom, you can stand up for what you believe in. You can have courage of conviction in a courtroom.
He transformed, as you said, it's a film about transformation from this kind of typical sort of suburban burger, you know, barrister doing, you know, wills and things like that, into this internationally famous figure. He was the go-to man for civil rights disputes ranging from the prisoner riots in Attica to the standoff with Native Americans and the federal authorities at Wounded Knee. Were you aware that he was so famous? I mean, you were aware that he was a person who was under threat at times. But were you aware that he was this big figure outside of your life?
it seemed to Emily and I that our father was at the center of everything important that had ever happened. And so we had a sense that of him as like this hero who swooped in these tremendous events and got to play a part.
And just walking to school with him every day, Sarah and I went to a school that was maybe 4 blocks from our family home. It would take us 25 to 30 minutes to walk there because every 10 feet someone would stop to talk to him.
And how did you feel about that?
This is Sarah. We liked it. It was our experience. We didn't know it any other way. That's who our dad was. And, you know, I mean, it could be annoying if you had to go somewhere. But our father had this presence and this life. And it kind of took us out of this solipsistic little world of our childhood and made us realize that there was a world out there and things were happening.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We're speaking with Emily and Sarah Kunstler. They are the daughters of famed civil rights attorney William Kunstler, and they have produced a new documentary about their father. It's called William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe. You know, the film takes all the chapters in William Kunstler's life. In fact, there was this period when he was always a polarizing figure once he became a civil rights activist and lawyer. But then there was a point at which you say he seemed to become, what's the word I'm looking for, like a media junkie, that you said he couldn't get enough. He participated in a mock trial of Tyrone the Cat. There's a short clip I want to play about that. Here it is.
What, in your expert opinion, is the relationship between cats and human beings? Is it a friendly one, a hostile one?
It was official. Sarah and I agreed. Our father had completely lost his mind.
What was going on there? Have you ever figured it out? Why was he doing that?
This is Emily speaking. Fox called him and said that they were doing this trial against cats, all cats, for crimes against humanity. And he couldn't turn it down. You know, it was a nationally broadcast mock trial, and he loved it. You know, he really appreciated the theater of the courtroom.
And what do you think about that?
At that time, you know, I have to say, Sarah and I had cats, and we didn't want the cat to lose. But it was still embarrassing that our father was the person standing between, you know, the cat.
This is Sarah. He was a tremendously embarrassing dad. You know, I mean, I think as far as dads go, we were always dying inside when he was publicly embarrassing us. You know, as far as his relationship with publicity, there's no question that he loved it. Every night he would walk our dog around the corner and get every single newspaper, the evening edition, so he could see what was being said about him. We had to watch every news show that evening to see if he was on it. And he knew that if he was on a case, that case would get attention. So it wasn't just for him publicity for publicity's sake. It was a tool that he used to bring attention to things that he thought mattered.
One of the cases you wished he had not taken, and you're both clear about this in the film, is that of Yusuf Salam. He was one of the men convicted of assaulting a female jogger in Central Park as part of a group, a wilding pack, as it were. The case caused widespread outrage. Your father spent years fighting the case, appealing the conviction. Later, after your father's death, Salam was found to be innocent, and he was freed from prison. You interviewed him for the film. This is what he had to say.
The legacy that Bill Kunstler has left is his fights and his struggles were, or became also my fights and my struggles. You know, anytime you have injustice or anytime you're faced with any kind of injustice and you're in a position to do something, you have to do something.
Emily, can I ask you, you talk about how in the film you pleaded with your dad not to take mm-hmm. that case. Your dad said, well, you know what? It's in the Constitution. Everybody deserves a lawyer. And you would say, yes, but does it have to be you? Mm-hmm. And when you think about that, what do you think?
You know, making this film, one of the greatest gifts that it gave Sarah and I was the opportunity to meet Yusuf and his family. You know, we think about the sacrifices that we made and the risks that we took for our father to live the life that he did. And after meeting Yusuf and coming to understand his life and his story, those sacrifices seem really small in comparison. Yusuf spent 7.5 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit, and we had to be made uncomfortable so our father could stand up for him and help protect his rights. And, you know, we at this point, it seems like a worthy sacrifice.
Sarah, what about you? When you think about the whole arc of your father's life, what do you think?
You know, Emily and I talk about this. And when our father died, we definitely wanted to reconcile him. We wanted all of his life to make sense. We wanted all of his choices to be good choices. And it's the sentiment of a child to want your parent to be consistent at all times. And one of the things that the conclusions we came to in making this film is that the search for consistency is flawed from the outset, and that real change happens in inconsistent moments, in gray moments, and that the only way we're going to move forward as a nation is, you know, is by not being afraid to act in those moments.
Sarah and Emily Kunstler wrote, directed, and produced the new documentary, William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe. Ladies, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
And now to a very different look at the justice system. Law professor and former federal prosecutor Paul Butler has written a new book, Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. He says hip-hop reveals difficult truths about American crime and punishment. And Paul Butler shared some of his favorite songs for our occasional feature we call In Your Ear.
So one song I'm listening to now is called Misunderstood, and it's by Lil Wayne. It's on his most recent album, The Carter Three. I love Misunderstood because in it, he's got this dry lecture about the criminal justice system. It's about a minute passage where he talks about how many people in the U.S. are locked up, and specifically how many African-American men are locked up.
You see, one in every 100 Americans are locked up. One in every 9 Black Americans are locked up.
And he talks about the reasons why, including for using and selling drugs, a crime that blacks are disproportionately locked up for. And he kind of breaks it down. One of the amazing things about this track is he's actually smoking a marijuana cigarette while he raps about criminal justice. So he's keeping it real. It's a great beat, a great song. That's why the album got nominated for a Grammy Award.
I love being misunderstood. Why? Because I live in the suburbs, but I come from the hood. Bring the hook in.
Another song I'm listening to, it's The Sound of the Police by KRS-One. And it's a critique of the police for racial profiling, but it's actually a broader theoretical critique of the way that we construct crime in the United States. KRS makes this point that we, United States citizens, we guard our land from Indians. It was stolen land. So he's got this great line, there can never be real justice on stolen land. But then he talks about how the police harass minorities, especially young black men. And he goes from this kind of alliteration thing, sound of the police, sound of the police. He blends that to the sound of the beast. And he makes this analogy between prison and slavery, an analogy that comes up all the time in hip-hop music. So it's an old school. Again, this is all pop music that people dance to. And the third song that I just love is called Danger by Erykah Badu. First time I heard this song was on a dance floor at a club in Atlanta. And it starts out with this sample of a collect call from prison.
Brother's got this complex
occupation.
And it's her boyfriend. He's about to get out of prison. She accepts the call. She can't wait to see him. At the same time, she's scared because he might start dealing drugs again, and that makes her unsafe. So this song is about the collateral consequences of prison, about how people do time on the outside. It's not just the person who's being locked up, who's being punished, and how the criminal justice system ought to take that into account. Erykah Badu is the goddess. She's just awesome, and this is one of her most brilliant songs.
Paul Butler teaches law at George Washington University. He's the author of the new book, Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. He tells us more about how hip-hop can show us what's wrong with the criminal justice system and how to fix it. That conversation is just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the recession forces the closure of another family of small newspapers, including the pioneering gay paper, The Washington Blade. We'll hear more about these publications and what it means, not just to gay readers, but to all people who care about diverse voices in the news. We'll have that conversation in a moment. But first, earlier in the program, we talked about a new film that discusses the life and career of the crusading lawyer William Kunstler. During his decades-long career, he took on the defense of protesters, accused rapists, and alleged terrorists when he believed their rights or a critical principle of our justice system was at stake. But today, do attorneys still have a place at the forefront of the fight for social justice? Paul Butler believes they do. He's a professor of law at George Washington University and the author of the new book, Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. And he joins us now in our Washington, D.C. studio. Welcome. Thank you for coming.
Hey, Michelle. Great to be here.
So what is a hip-hop theory of justice?
Hip-hop is doing this ground-level reporting on how criminal justice system really works. And it's created by the people who know the system best. African-American young men are the most incarcerated group of people in the history of the world. So they're telling us how trials work, whether the police are fair, about prosecutors and defense attorneys, and they're doing it in tracks that you can dance to. It's really an amazing moment in pop culture history.
Is there a track or something you would direct us to? Because I have to tell you, I was watching videos just the other night, and I saw a lot of guys rolling around in dollar bills and putting on jewelry. I didn't hear a lot about the criminal justice system.
You see the police ever present. There can be the sweetest, sappiest hip-hop song. I'm thinking about this song this summer called Kiss Me on the Phone, about a boy saying goodbye to his girlfriend. And the police are there. They're everywhere in hip-hop. You know, you can watch all these sitcoms, read all these books about vampires. You can go to listen to country music. You'd never know that there are 2.5 million people in prison. You can't listen to urban radio more than 20 minutes without being reminded of that fact.
You know, you wrote a piece for the progressive magazine The Nation, which is tied to your book. It's titled 10 Things You Can Do to Reduce Incarceration. Among the things you recommend that people do is listen to hip hop. But I'm still not seeing the connection between listening to hip hop and reducing incarceration. Why? Why do you recommend it?
Because not only do these people come from communities where they're most likely to be accused of crime, they also come from communities where they're most likely to be victims of crime. And so, you know, some of these people are scared to death. And again, they're telling us about that when we listen to their music. They're telling us about ways that we can be safer and more free. The problem they're describing with criminal justice now is it just doesn't work.
And I want to talk more about some of the things that you recommend. You were once a federal prosecutor, so I don't think it'll surprise many people that among the other things you encourage people to do is do your jury duty. Why is that important?
Because jurors have all this power. I was a prosecutor in D.C., and I was told when I was a rookie that sometimes in criminal cases with drug possession especially, we persuade the jurors beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was guilty, and they would still find him not guilty. And these were mostly African-American jurors. And the reason was because they didn't want to send another black man to jail. And when I started trying cases, I found that to be exactly the case. It's called jury nullification. It's perfectly legal. It's a strategy that's been used to get rid of laws like the slavery law. It's worked. So in the book, I suggest a strategic way. I call for these Martin Luther King jurors to selectively nullify, to protest this war on drugs.
It's an interesting point because there are other ways in which you essentially urge people as a matter of conscience not to participate with the police. Just say no to the police. Don't be a professional snitch. You say don't accept money for cooperating with the police. But you also say, as you just mentioned, if you're a juror in a nonviolent drug case, vote not guilty. And there are critics who've taken issue with it. They're maybe very sympathetic with your desire to see fewer black men, particularly and black people in general, incarcerated because of the destructive effect on communities. But they also make the point of, who are you to say that that's a nonviolent crime? If you have people in some communities, there have been stories about people, you know, firebombing people's houses just because they ask drug dealers to move from their front porch. I mean, so who are you to say that's a nonviolent crime?
No, what I'm interested in, Michelle, is something that works. And things are getting worse, not better. There are more people locked up now than there were in, like, the 90s when you and I started talking about this stuff. And drugs are ever present. So what I'm looking for is a way to really get the dope boys off the street corners. That's what makes people feel unsafe. And we got better ways to do that than locking up everybody, because the result in places like D.C. and Baltimore is that about half of the young black men in their 20s have a criminal case.
You know, you're saying that things are getting worse and not better. It is true that the United States has one of the highest incarceration rates in the world, and the highest according to peer economies. If you look at places in Europe with similar economies and sort of social structures, democratic governments and so forth. On the other hand, the level of violence in most places around the country is far lower than it was. The murder rate is far lower than it was even 10 years ago. Even in D.C., the murder rate is lower than it was 10 years ago. In New York and Washington, the homicide rate is on track to be the lowest it's been in 30 years. So how can you say it's getting worse?
Well, New York has actually reduced the prison population and at the same time reduced its crime rate. It turns out that there's this tipping point with locking people up, where when too many people are locked up, that actually increases crime. So in jurisdictions that have safely reduced the prison population, they've seen their crime rate go down. So we got to be strategic about this. It's about being smart on crime rather than just this tough on crime nonsense.
Talk to me a little bit more, if you would, in the couple of minutes that we have left about why you feel incarceration is so bad. And what exactly about incarceration, in your view, makes it so destructive that you have to take what I think some people would say extreme steps in order to stop the rate of increase?
Mm-hmm. So just to be clear, I'm not against all incarceration. So if you're going to rob, rape, murder, then yeah, you ought to be locked up for the protection of society. My concern is how we're using it for nonviolent offenders. Again, 500,000 people are actually locked up for committing a nonviolent drug offense. And that's way too many. If it actually got the dope boys off the street corner, maybe I'd support it, but it doesn't do that. What we're doing is disrupting families. You know, about half of the men and way more than half of the women who are in prison have children. And if they're in prison, that puts their kids at risk for going to prison. And again, so many people in some communities are locked up that getting locked up is a rite of passage. And in hip hop, it's called catching a case. It's kind of like catching the flu, a little bit your fault, a little bit the luck of the draw. And so the criminal law, in my scholarly language, is losing its deterrent effect. People don't have respect for the system anymore. We've got to make the system more respectable. And we can do that by being more strategic about who we lock up.
Do you think these ideas are gaining traction? I guess what I'm asking you is, do you think that anybody's listening outside of the people who listen to hip-hop?
Absolutely. So this isn't at all a geeky legal book. I wrote this for people who watch TV shows like CSI or The Wire. So this is the nonfiction version of that. I'm talking about the evolution of street knowledge. And the message is getting out. So President Obama has said that it's blind and counterproductive to lock up nonviolent drug offenders. He's called the war on drugs a failure. That's his word, not mine. So now we got to ask him to put some action behind that rhetoric. And so, you know, I think Attorney General Eric Holder has been very encouraging on these issues. We just got to get everybody to understand it's a priority. Again, it's not about coddling criminals. It's about being smart on crime so that we can all be safer and more free.
Paul Butler is a professor at George Washington University Law School. His new book is Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. He joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studio. If you want to read the article in The Nation that we've also been talking about, we'll have a link on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Programs, and then on Tell Me More. Paul Butler, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
This week, one of the nation's oldest and most respected gay papers, the Washington Blade, abruptly shut its doors. After a long financial struggle, the paper's owner, Window Media, ceased production of the Blade and four other small gay-oriented publications under its wing in Florida and Georgia. Some two dozen employees of the Blade showed up for work on Monday, only to find out they'd be packing boxes instead of putting out a paper. But one former Blade writer, Zach Rosen, responded to the news in the same way he's been doing full-time for much of the past year. He went to his computer and posted his reaction online. Rosen is the co-founder and editor-in-chief of thenewgay.net. That's a website for everyone over the rainbow, as he puts it. And his post was titled, Gay Media is Dead, Long Live Gay Media. And Zach Rosen joins me now in our Washington, D.C. studio to talk about whether gay media is dead and what the future of gay media might be. Welcome. Thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you.
So there are two sides to your argument, as your title implies. Let's take them in turn. You worked at The Blade for 2 years, from 2006 to 2008. It was your first full-time journalism job. Congratulations.
Thank
right
you.
Out of college. So you say that The Blade's demise was a terrible loss. Why is it a terrible loss for people who've never seen it? What could you find in The Blade that you couldn't find in other media?
In The Washington Blade, you could find well-reported, well-researched, and well-fact-checked news. There is no kind of celebrity pandering in their news section. It was news the way that the Chicago Tribune or the New York Times would give you news for gay people.
But you also write, for as much as the Washington Blade's news coverage has been a boon for its readers, its culture coverage amounts to nothing less than a shackle. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's kind of two sides to gay life at this point, I'd say. There's the politics, and then there's our actual lives. And I'd say 30 years ago, you could find out that somebody was gay and pretty much know what bars they went to, what music they listened to, what they dressed like. And it's just not the case anymore. We've come much farther than that. And I think that The Blade's culture coverage presents a very, very, very narrow view of what it means to be gay.
Do you think that was intentional?
I don't think it's intentional. I think it's
Well, I'm just thinking about the early days of, no disrespect to anybody, but Ebony magazine, for example, mm-hmm. was very interested in putting the best foot forward. They saw it as an antidote to the depictions of African Americans that they saw elsewhere in the mainstream media, which is mainly about crime and dysfunction. And so they're very interested in, you know, the Supremes.
Right.
Know, they're very interested in Colin Powell. You know, they're very interested in people who are considered sort of A-list achievers. And they figure that this the other stuff is covered elsewhere. But they were and you know, you can argue with that. But do you think it was that sense that the paper was not just by and for the gay community, but also kind of an ambassador to the rest of the society? Or do you think maybe that's just what they thought was important?
I think it's just what they thought was important, actually. I know the mechanism you're talking about, and I think that's found in individual gay citizens mostly. And you'll see that when people say, how dare you kiss your boyfriend on the street? We're not going to get married now because you put this awful image of us forward to everybody. I think The Blade was just because they had a sex advice column. They had personal ads in the back. If they're trying to give a pristine impression of the community, they weren't doing it very well.
Your site slogan is for everybody over the rainbow. The rainbow, of course, being a longtime symbol of the gay rights movement. But what do you mean by that? How do you get who's over the rainbow?
Oh, well, I think at this point, I know it started out with these great notions, but I think the gay rainbow is a myth. It's the gay rainbow, the way I picture it, is just one big black and white band. There's kind of everyone that gets covered in traditional gay media, and there's everyone who's not. And right now, everyone who is covered is outnumbered by the other folks, probably 9-1.
So what is it that you're trying to do with your publication that takes it to another level, that takes it beyond and is more, what's the word I'm looking for, inclusive than you think that The Blade was?
I think, and again, this is only The Blade's culture coverage, not their news. I think it's time for modern queer media to reflect modern queer lives, and The Blade did not. I think that gay people have their stories. They have all this in different music. They go to different bars. They eat at different restaurants. And they might not do capital G gay things all the time, but they're still gay in whatever they do. I don't think you should have to choose between having a functioning gay social and dating life or being yourself. I think there's a way to do both. So we just kind of want to make sure that people see their lives reflected in gay media, even if it's not only going to 17th Street, which is the gay district here in D.C., even if it's not an eternal hunt for sex, even if it's not buttoned up and fancy all the time, it's not all male.
See, what I'm thinking is it also about some aspects of gay life that might be politically incorrect.
Right.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, actually, I am. It's you might have just given me a soapbox inadvertently because I can talk about this a lot. I always say that if the rights that we fight for are, if we're given rights as this kind of sanitized, buttoned up, best little boy in the world culture, then we're only going to be allowed to be a sanitized culture. Like, people should know that some gay people are non-monogamous relationships, some are in polyamorous relationships, some gay people may not shower in the morning. You know, I think that all facets of this community should be we shouldn't be telling these salacious sex stories, but I think we should be kind of intelligently and honestly examining what our lives are like today. That's what people are scared of gay sex. You know, no matter how much we brush our teeth in the morning, they don't want gay people out there having sex. So it makes sense to examine what gay sex culture is like, for example, as a way as it pertains to I guess you'd say straight society versus pretending that gay people don't have sex and that we're going to be these polite little, you know, man and man next door with our pink flamingos on our lawns, I guess, if that makes sense.
I don't know anybody with a pink flamingo on their lawn. Well, the people I know with pink flamingos on their lawn aren't necessarily gay. I didn't really know that that was
I was just trying to think of what clean suburbia is. It's not a gay thing. It's a boy next door thing.
Oh, okay. I got you. Now, you know, the closure of the Blade and the four other publications that Window Media shut down, now that the loss of a newspaper is not something that's just being experienced by the gay community. In fact, it's been a big issue in journalism particularly since the recession began. So I'm interested to know, what do you think is next? That's a question I think a lot of people in journalism have who are serving lots of different audiences. Your publication is online only. Do you think that's the wave of the future if you're interested in serving particular communities? Do you think that's the future of journalism? Is it online?
I think the lesson here is media should respect its readers first and foremost. It should not be the other way around. Media should reflect the needs of its readers. It should reflect the culture those readers live in. If a publication's online, has very little overhead, they get so much freedom in terms of of content they can post and quality and depth of writing that just is going to blow anything else in print away.
Zach Rosen, co-founder and editor-in-chief of thenewgay.net, for, as their slogan says, everyone over the rainbow. He joined us in our Washington, D.C. studio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
That's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Breckin Booker, Jasmine Garst, Lee Hill, Douglas Hopper, Arjun Hutchins, Jennifer Longmire-Wright, Emily Oxenschlager, and Jack Zahora. Our interns are Monica Anderson and Hope Lehman. Our planning editor is Louise Clemens. Our senior editor is Vicki Walton-James. Our senior producers are Alicia Montgomery, Peter Breslow, and J.J. Sutherland. The program is directed by Rob Sachs and Monica Evstatieva. Our technical director is Kimberly Jones. She had a hand this week from Neil Tivolt. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior producer is Tashima Walker. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow.